introduce ourselves. First, my name is David Wee. I have spent my adult life as an English professor at St. Olaf College. I did that for 40 years. And one of the courses that I taught for over 30 years was a course on baseball and American culture. And I must tell you that whenever I went to a meeting of English professors, as we do from time to time, and we'd, over a beer, be talking about what we taught, what was our field of studies, whenever I mentioned that I taught a course on baseball, the response always was, "You lucky guy! How did you get to do that?" Now, they didn't care that I taught Victorian literature and various other things. So I've done this for quite a while. And I must tell you that the two most interesting class sessions that stick in my mind, one at St. Olaf and one here at Holden Village, were when we started out with this kind of, we're going to do this in a minute with you folks, seeing how many people can identify these numbers and these nicknames and so forth. At St. Olaf, it was a 9-year-old girl who knew the answer to everything. And at Holden Village, it was a 9-year-old boy that I'd like to introduce you to now.
Thomas.
So my name is Thomas, and I met David at Holden probably 15 years ago, give or take. I'm going into my junior year at Augustana College, so I'm no longer that 9-year-old boy. But I grew up in the state of Washington, loving baseball. My grandpa kind of introduced it to me. Went to my first baseball game in 1996 at the King Dome. Saw that bright green AstroTurf, and my life was changed. As I got older, played some Little League and some Junior Babe Ruth, and realized I wasn't a very good baseball player, and ended up trading in my glove, and now I run a lot and run for Paulson here at Augustana. So, like David, we love baseball, but ended up as runners. And
that's right. I was a good field, no hit.
Yeah, I see. Couldn't hit at all. So, yeah, that's kind of my story.
Okay. Well, what we'll start out with is what we call batting practice. And that is what you do before the game really gets started and the players all get warmed up. And the way we'll do this is to see how many of these numbers and names are familiar to you. And what I think we'd like is when we point to one number, and those of you who do know what it means, raise your hand. Don't shout out the answer right away. But then we'll ask one of you to tell the rest of the group. This is in part for all of us to find out how many of us here are also baseball crazies. But we want to assure all of you that it doesn't matter if you know the answers to any of these things. The fascinating thing is that some of these things happened and are true, and that some of these nicknames were developed. So this is not a means to have you fail a quiz right at the start, but just to see how many people here recognize these things. I'll start out with a few and then you can take over here. 162. Anyone else know what that is? Okay. Fred?
It's the number of games in a season?
Yeah.
The regular season?
In the regular season. That's right. Did you have another reason for that one?
No. It was 154 was a, what do you say?
Yeah, it used to be 154. Until life as people my age grew up with 8 teams in each league suddenly changed and the world was upside down. 0.406. Okay, several of you know that.
Ted Williams.
And what? Ted Williams batted 406 one season, and why is that especially interesting?
That's a tough average to keep.
Yeah, it's, and he's the last person.
Last person.
did a whole season and batted over 400. Who knows what year it was?
I really don't know anything about baseball.
Yeah.
But does that mean that he hit like about 41% of the balls?
Is that what that means? That 41% of the times that he came to bat,
he
got a hit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This happened in 1941. A long time ago, since anyone has... Some people have gotten fairly close, but not quite.
I think, just to jump in, one thing that makes baseball so unique is this is an incredible number. Normally the number that you see that we look at for kind of standard is maybe 300.
Yeah.
So how many other sports is failing two-thirds of the time excellent?
Yeah.
If that was football, it'd be pretty bad. Basketball?
Yeah.
Pretty bad.
That's right. Good point. One of the toughest things to do in all of sports is to hit a pitched ball into the right place. And the other interesting thing about Ted Williams that year was that after the next to the last game of the season, he was batting...
what did we say, 399?
Yeah, I think 399. Mm-hmm. And the manager said, you know, I won't make you play the last few games. Maybe he was batting...
I think he was batting 400. He was batting at 400.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the manager said, look, you don't have to play. There was a doubleheader the next day. So we don't have to risk that you'll drop below 400. He said, I'm playing those games.
You know what he was doing the next season? In 42?
In flying airplanes.
He was in the Marine Corps.
In the Marine Air Force, yeah. But in the final day of the season, in the doubleheader, he went 6 for 8. And got his average up there. This one, 56. Anyone else know that?
Somebody.
Okay, go for it.
Number of consecutive games with hits by Joe DiMaggio.
Excellent.
Yeah. Whoa!
Yeah. Okay, why don't you look over here.
755?
Go ahead. Number of home runs by Henry Aaron.
Yep.
Yeah.
762, put it in parentheses with an asterisk. Why is that?
Well, that's Bobby Bonds' steroid arms.
Oh,
Barry Bonds, but
yeah.
Barry Bonds.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So.
That's the new all-time home run record.
714.
Babe Ruth's home run.
Yep.
Good.
2,130 and 2,632.
Consecutive game record.
Yeah. First one was Lou Gehrig, and second is Cal Ripken
Jr.
I always used to use 2130 as my PIN number, you know, because I could remember that. It's been etched in my mind.
Why are there two? What's it, a longer season? It's probably one of the records, the last record that will never, ever be broken.
Yeah.
2,130 games played in a row. Seldom do players play 162. Seldom players play 150.
What's 2,632?
Oh, that's Cal Ripken's games.
Oh,
played.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, okay.
So I can explain that. 0.215.
Is that the Mendoza line?
It's the Mendoza
line. Bingo, way to go. That's right. And that is famous for what reason?
That's the level that the guy went to the minors.
Yeah, it's a batting average below which no player wants to hit.
Mario Mendoza, right?
Mario Mendoza, yeah.
42. You made 42? This is Jackie Robinson's number.
Oh.
It's the only number retired by every team in Major League Baseball.
You do.
Only a few players still wear it. Grandfather Danny. Mariano Rivera's one off the top of my head that wears number 42.
And in one game this season, every player in the major leagues wore number 42 on his uniform.
Jackie Robinson Day.
Jackie Robinson Day, yeah.
262.
Single season hits record.
Yep. By
Ichiro.
Yep. 511.
that Ty Cobb's total wins?
Cy Young.
Cy Young.
Cy Young. Cy Young. Yeah. Ty Cobb's got stolen bases.
Yeah. 316.
And that is the major league record for most wins in a career by one person.
316. That's the total losses by a career, or in a career, by a major league pitcher.
Also, early win.
Cy Young.
Yeah. I go back to 5'11". When I was teaching a class, it was mostly to people aged about like our group here, many St. Olaf alumni, graduates and so forth. There was one 9-year-old person in the class. Raised her hand, every statistic that went up, her hand went up. And I called on her a couple times, and it was always the right answer. Till finally, 5'11 came up. She was the only one in the room to raise her hand, just like you, on some of these questions. And everyone was paying attention, and she said, well, that's the major league record for wins in a career by any individual, and it was by Cy Young. People's jaws were dropping. You know, a 9-year-old girl who was saying these things. And then a middle-aged gentleman sitting in the audience said, and by the way, that's the number of career home runs that Ernie Banks hit. Madeline's hand. She said Ernie Banks hit 512. She was right.
How did she know all that stuff?
Oh boy.
She and I were on a television program a few months later when this word got out. And she was asked that by the television interviewer. How do you know all those things? And she said, well, I have a lot of books in my house, and I read them.
Great answer.
Yeah. 1.12.
Lowest earned run average. Some of these
lowest. So lowest 1 year earned run average by a starting pitcher. And who did it?
Bob Gibson.
Bob Gibson. Oh, yeah, you knew that.
Yeah, Bob Gibson.
Bob Gibson.
64?
68. 1968. And what is the lowest batting average that has won a league championship for batting? An individual. The league's batting champion. 301. Grandpa's kind of boring. this was Carl Yastrzemski, who won the American League batting championship. His average was actually .3005, but they always round up. These two things happened in the same year. In other words, the pitchers were getting too much of an advantage over the batters. So one of the rare dimensional changes in baseball history, what did they do?
Lowered the mound.
They lowered the pitching mound from 15 inches high to 10 inches high to try to keep an even playing field.
What year was that?
I believe it was 1968. And this figure is down there as kind of extra. This is $83,870. Yes?
About the highest paid to a player, is it today or something?
Joe Mauer makes the game.
That would be one of the.
Is it what Joe Mauer makes the game?
Well, this is obscure. Nobody would know this. But my hero, who is Andy Pafko, had his, I saw a headline in the newspaper with his name in it just a few years ago on my way out to Holden Village. And he retired in 1959, so he's not in the news very much. His baseball card from 1952 Tops series had sold at auction for $83,000. And I've got the card, of course. I have all of his baseball cards, because I stuck them in a scrapbook. And Karen's first thought was, David, we could build a cabin.
Good plan.
We still have the car, but we also have a cabin, too. Can I go with some of the nicknames? Should we do that?
So what are the salaries, and I kind of know, but what are their salaries now?
Well, for
somebody said that per game. That's about right.
Yeah.
For some of them.
It's more than that. I think it's in the triple.
What?
Yeah.
Per game. It's like a house.
Yeah, people are making $20 million a year to play baseball.
A year?
So I'm sorry, he's getting 27.
That's insane.
Yeah. A-Rod is getting 27. Joe Mauer's just turned out to be, what, 20?
23 million.
23 million, yeah.
Whoa, by the twins.
Yeah.
Didn't somebody get paid like 82 in this decision just a little bit ago?
Not for 1 year.
That's over a whole bunch.
Oh, that's over for several years at a time.
Yeah, actually, that's fine.
Okay, try some of these.
You start down tomorrow.
Okay, start down.
Georgia Peach. Somebody know who the Georgia
Peach? Just shout out the name if you know who this is.
Ty Cobb.
Ty Cobb. The Ancient Mariner.
Yeah, he stopped with one of three. Right?
Bingo.
Short
it
stuff.
Didn't have anything to do with the Seattle Mariners, although one of the Mariners players was a Gaylord Perry.
Yeah, it was also went by that name.
Went by that name because he was 43 years old and still playing for the Mariners.
Baller.
But who knows the.
So Coleridge is wrong there.
It's from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The opening two lines are, it is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one in three. So it has become the generic nickname for an ill-fielding infielder. He can only stops one in three. So, okay. Oh, and I'll do these next two. Bow Wow, there's a player whose last name is Arft, A-R-F-T, and they call him Bow Wow Arft.
What'd you say?
A young R&B performer.
And Fire, anyone know that? Who was nicknamed Fire?
Who was Bow Wow?
Hank Arft. A-R-F-T. Perfect name for him. Fire, this was Virgil Trucks, who was a relief pitcher for the Detroit Tigers, and they called him Fire Truck. Put out the fire. Okay, go ahead.
Catfish.
Hunter?
Hunter. Catfish Hunter. The Hebrew Hammer.
Sandy Koufax.
No.
Good guess. Good guess, yeah.
Ryan Braun of the Milwaukee Brewers. El Duque. Yeah, Orlando Hernandez, he was a Cuban defector, came across on a raft from Cuba and pitched for the New York Yankees, won some World Series in the late 90s. The Ryan Express.
Nolan Ryan.
The Iron Horse and the Iron Man, they go together.
Lou Gehrig
and Cal Ripken Jr. His predecessor, I guess, with the record. Mr. October.
Reggie Jackson,
who in what year hit four consecutive home runs in the World Series?
1978.
Against the Dodgers.
Against the Dodgers.
Glumly spoken.
Yeah. Where are we? Pudge.
Fisk.
Carlton Fisk, they got that.
Yeah, good.
Also, Bob Rodriguez.
No.
The Yankee Clipper.
Joe
Bone.
Jay Buhner.
Jay Buhner. Long time right fielder for the
Rams.
Oh, sure. Hammer and Hank. Dash. This is a fun one.
Yeah, I just learned this one from him today.
Ryan Roland Smith.
Oh, really?
Relief pitcher for the Seattle Mariners. He's from Australia. But he's the only player in Major League history to have a hyphenated last name.
What? He also drives a
dash.
Dash.
That's all.
That's right. Shouldn't be hyphen, but
yeah.
Close enough.
Yes.
the big unit. The Flying Hawaiian.
Shane Victorino.
Who called? Toyo. And Dr. Strangelove.
Stewart.
No, Marv Thronberry.
That's it. Marv Thronberry. Dick Stewart was in the same category of player. but Marv Thronberry was such an inept fielding first baseman for the Mets that he was got a strange club.
How much did he get paid?
Not much. I remember the Mets
made
fans.
Commercials.
Yeah, made commercials. Mets fans used to wear T-shirts with the word VRAM on it. Marv spelled backwards. Which seemed to be the only appropriate thing to do for him. Well, we could do this for a long time, but I think that's enough for now. You're warmed up, and some of you are firing on all cylinders. One of the things that I get asked constantly is, what do you do in a college course about baseball? And I'm going to give a quick description of the kinds of things we do. The way I teach it, at least. It's an interdisciplinary course, because I'm an English professor and I know a fair number of well-written baseball novels, it's a perfect thing for me because I can teach literature and baseball at the same time. But here are the kind of questions that I think are important in a baseball class. In the field of literature, why do so many American novelists use baseball as a framework for their stories? How many stories do you know of that are founded on lacrosse or hockey or wrestling? I mean, there are a few, you know, but...
Track and field.
Whoa. But there is a book about baseball published every day of the year in the United States. Over 400 books a year on baseball in this country. They aren't all good, as you can well imagine. They aren't all novels. You know, some of them are my career in baseball by, you know, some utility infielder. But anyway, that many books. What kinds of themes or topics do these novels and books address? And why in the world so many baseball books? And there's language that we study. Why have so many baseball terms become common to our everyday expression? And if we have time, we'll get into that later on. There are countless metaphors that are part of baseball. To get to first base on this, you know, start jotting down any baseball terms you can think of. You know, I couldn't get to first base with her. I'll take a rain check on that. You know, if we took half an hour, we'd fill this, have to erase it, fill it again with baseball terms that have become common parlance. And why are nicknames so important? You know, the colorfulness of these nicknames, some of them descriptive of a player's ability, sometimes having to do with the spelling of his last name. You know. they give a certain color to this sport and other sports too. Religion is a big thing we take up in the baseball course. Why are so many Americans devoted? I use that word exactly. Why do we give so much devotion to baseball, other sports as well? Why do we care so deeply? You know, why do some of us spend more time reading the box scores than reading poetry in any given day, at least in the summer? Why do we make pilgrimages to sacred places, to Fenway Park, to Wrigley Field, to Cooperstown? And almost always we use the term pilgrimage when we go to these places. Economics. Why and how do we devote so much public and private money to this child's game. The stadium disputes that every city goes through until finally they decide to build a new stadium. And meanwhile, social programs for the needy and education goes wanting. And we pay for these things. And why do we pay so much money to go to these games? If you have a family with three kids, you know, you can't go to a major league ball game for less than a couple $100, including buying the hot dogs and the cotton candy and all that. And how have baseball and other sports moved marginalized people into the mainstream of American economic life? And this is one of the reasons that we honor Jackie Robinson so much. And then psychology. Why do fans associate ourselves with one team and remain loyal forever to that team? Perhaps, you know, even when Walter O'Malley took the Brooklyn Dodgers to Los Angeles, many New Yorkers, Brooklynites, never forgave Walter O'Malley and remained Brooklyn Dodger fans forever, still are. Whereas others of us simply become fans of the handiest team, the nearby team. What's going on with this? Why do cities go crazy when their team wins the World Series? What are we doing that for?
Jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah. There's a lot of personal investment in the team we care for. Then ethics. Do sports teach character? When we read the sports pages, there seems to be as much news about major league in all sports, athletes being indicted for this, being suspended for that. They seem to be, to the casual reader of the pages, criminals. And of course, in the early years of baseball, the baseball players were viewed as hooligans, and many people thought it was a low-class game. History. In what way has baseball developed alongside American historical progress? How did baseball begin? Is baseball really the American pastime? And why or why not? And this always gets a debate amongst football fans and baseball fans and basketball fans. Then we take up metaphysics. Consider how the game of baseball works, how it differs from other games, its rules, its action, its use of space and time. And as you all know, I think, it's one of the few sports in which there's no clock governing the game. A baseball game could and sometimes does, you know, run well into the next day, or could go on virtually forever, because until one team ends the game with more runs than the other, it must continue. Aesthetics. Is baseball beautiful? How and in what ways? Why has our life changed forever when you walk in to the ballpark? How many of you can remember, or do you have a pang when you remember for the first time you stepped into a Major League Baseball stadium and just took a breath like this, this beautiful field which is so much different from a basketball court, that's the stability, let's say, of a football field. Every baseball park, some of us prefer to call it a park instead of a field or a stadium, may have different dimensions, some of them. Statistics. How important are numbers to our fascination with baseball? The fact that we can count virtually everything and then remember the statistics. Is that part of our fascination? Because, you know, football doesn't count every time the left guard makes a good block on count everything in baseball. Why is the biggest book in my library, and perhaps yours, the Baseball Encyclopedia? Mm-hmm. Just simply filled with statistics. Two more things. Sociology. What role does baseball and other sports play in our social arrangements? The development of cities, the survival of small towns, race relations, the status of women. How does baseball fit into those issues? And then lastly, art, film, music, theater. Does baseball work in these media? Why do we have so many good baseball movies? And if we have time, we'll ask you about baseball movies and your favorites. Now, since literature was the first one of these, Thomas is going to reintroduce us, remind us of one of America's greatest poems. Last week, if any of you were here for my session on the project where Americans were asked to name their favorite poem, Casey at the Bat was named by many, many people. So here it is.
Casey at the Bat. This is written in 1888 by Ernest Lawrence Taylor. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first and Bowers did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought, if only Casey could get a whack at that, we'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a Lulu, and the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude grew melancholy sat, where there seemed but little chance of Casey is getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted, and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second, and Flynn a-hugging third. Then from 5,000 throats and more, there rose a lusty yell. It rumbled through the valley, it rattled in the dell. It pounded upon the mountain, it recoiled upon the flat, for Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing, and a smile lit Casey's face. And when, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 times applauded him and wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance flashed in Casey's eyes. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere comes hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of a storm wave on the stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone in the stands, and it's likely they'd have killed him had Casey not raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's vision shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew, but Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said strike two. "Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and an echo answered fraud. But one scornful look from Casey and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold, they saw his muscles strain, and he knew that Casey wouldn't let the ball go by again. The sneer has fled from Casey's lips, his teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright, the band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville, for mighty Casey has struck out.
You got your GD's response.
He did?
Oh, I thought he was going to get it.
I had to memorize that poem when I was probably 8 in second grade, along with other famous American poems, and it was probably one of the 4 or 5. So.
But now you're in college, and there are so many other complicated things to think about.
Well, no, I was just thinking, you know, Paul, one of your favorite books is The Brothers K. From baseball.
Yeah, oh,
so literature.
Yeah.
And it gives some great discussions about statistics. How they.
Now, I'm going to read a little thing. This is a little essay that was at the back of Newsweek magazine. Actually, it must have been here at the front. One of these one pagers that are often opinion pieces. This one is entitled "The Town That Gave a Man His Life Back." And I usually can't get through reading this aloud without pulling out the handkerchief. But this is written by Edith Hamilton and published in the year 2000. And whenever I read this to a group, there are tears at the end, but it's well written here. Every spring when the umpire yells, "Play ball!" in the first game of the season, I get teary-eyed again, wondering how that ball must have looked coming at my father on that pitcher's mound so long ago. It was a line drive in the summer of 1921. This is 79 years later that she's writing this. A purely magic time for my father, who had been discovered by a baseball scout on a red clay ballpark in the Mississippi Hill Country. He was 26, newly married, playing pickup ball after work. He was a southpaw, and And family legend says Dad's blazing fastball was so hard it once split his brother's hand when he caught it. How a baseball scout ever heard of my father remains a mystery, but he gave him a minor league contract to play in Exeter, Nebraska in the spring of 1921. Exeter is a small town in southeast Nebraska where the plains begin. Has anyone been in Exeter, to your knowledge? I think I'm going to make a pilgrimage there sometime. Its residents were crazy about baseball. They had a ball field and grandstands and intense rivalry with other minor league teams. My father's pitching statistics quickly made him a hero. My mother and their infant daughter, that is the writer herself, she was just a baby then, my mother and their infant daughter were feted by the townspeople with gifts and attention. The team was winning, and a regional title seemed certain as summer began to wane. Dad never talked about the line drive that shattered his ankle, ended his baseball career, and left him with a lifelong limp. In later years, he would show his grandchildren how to throw a curve or a slider. And in my mind's eye, I can still see their small fingers as he wrapped them around a baseball to demonstrate. But he never talked about that hit, capital T, capital H. I was an adult before I understood that most of us do not want to talk about our worst defeats. In 1958, while driving my parents to Kansas to visit my brother, I discovered that we were not far from Exeter. And I suggested that we drive there just to see the town that I had heard about all my life. My father protested that he did not want to go, but my mother and I persuaded him. When we reached Exeter, my parents were astounded. Interstate 80 had missed the town and the place was unchanged, quiet and serene. We were walking up the main street with my mother saying, "This is the cafe where we ate. This is the store where we bought our groceries." When we passed an elderly man who tipped his hat to us, stopped, did a classic double take, and came running back yelling, "Lefty Hamilton!" You're Lefty Hamilton. You are. You are. Don't ever tell me that baseball is not otherworldly. We went into a nearby cafe where the man got on the phone and began making calls. Soon a group of Lefty Hamilton fans, who had known my father 37 years before, hurried in and the party began. The laughter was so loud that the years seemed to vanish, leaving only that long ago summer perfectly preserved in time. I sat back watching my parents. They looked younger. My father looked happily dazed. The words of an old song came back to me, memories how they linger. The talk swirled around the table. How about that shutout game you pitched against, the day when you balked, and that suicide squeeze? When Dad expressed surprise that people still remembered him, a man replied, "Of course we remember. It's baseball, Lefty." I was dazed myself. These people, these wonderful people, still recalled my father, Lefty Hamilton, after all those years. He had pitched on a minor league team in a very small town for one brief summer season, and they remembered him. My parents' home had burned down years before the Exeter trip, and the only photo that had survived the flames was one of my father and the Exeter baseball team. It is charred on three corners, a priceless memento, and looking at it used to sadden me because I felt something had gone out of my father's life that summer. To have a dream come true and then have it snatched away so quickly is more devastating than never having it come true at all. But the Exeter trip changed my father. It reassured him that he was not forgotten, that the name of Lefty Hamilton still lives in baseball's pantheon of players. This October, I'll watch the World Series, and I will forget the obscene salaries, the fields that resemble amusement parks under the lights, the rent-a-player late-season trades. I won't even think about the ticket prices that bar many fans from ever seeing a Major League game in person. I'll be caught up in the ageless pageantry of baseball, and when that first pitch crosses the plate, all my memories will be of Exeter, Nebraska, the little town that gave a man's life back to him. That may seem over-sentimental, but it's the way baseball has worked on many of us in our lives. Now you've got another piece of a totally different tone, right? And more recent, today.
Yeah, I think baseball has played, it's such an old game, and has played such a role in many of our lives over generations. Professional football, basketball is a new sport. Those are new sports. They don't have that deep attachment to family. And it's, you talked about, you think about the film that they're showing later tonight with Kevin Costner, who gets to play catch with his dad in Field of Dreams. And what, I mean, that's a man cry movie right there, playing catch with your dad.
Grown men will cry tonight, but that will be...
Yeah, I mean... But this is a little more lighthearted story posted today online in the Seattle Times, and it's about love. It's entitled, "Cupid Strikes, Mariners Bullpen Catcher Marrying Woman He Spotted in the Stands." So I'll briefly read this. I thought this was pretty great, how this man was affected by baseball in a game that he'll never forget. Jason Phillips spotted a woman at Safeco Field last May. Knew he had to make a choice, be bold or ignored. As a Mariners bullpen catcher, he was used to being anonymous, used to spending half the year tucked away in the box with pitchers. It's a thankless job, he does well without complaint, but this time he needed to stand out and risk eternal regret. He shared a few stares with a woman who was entertaining a business client. Then he made a promise to the fellas in the pen, "If we go to extra innings, I'm going to make a move." Phillips said, "If we go to extra innings, that's got to be a sign." The game with the Oakland Athletics went into extra innings. Phillips grabbed a baseball, scribbled his number on it, got the woman's attention, and tossed it to her. For the rest of the game, he was left to wonder how she'd respond. He couldn't wait to return to the clubhouse and check his messages. But, naturally, the game would drag on for 15 excruciating innings. By the time he returned to the clubhouse and looked in his locker, she had sent him a text message. "My name is Molly. Nice to meet you." And that's how a bullpen catcher fell in love. On this Sunday, Jason Phillips and Molly Ray will get married. Their wedding guests will attend a ceremony in the only logical place to celebrate their serendipitous romance, the bullpen. The Mariners play Cincinnati this Sunday. As soon as the final out is recorded, the pen will be transformed to show off its glorious side. For a few hours, it won't be the place where boys get to be boys while waiting to put out fires. It will be ground zero for some of the filthiest verbal assaults that players receive from fans. It won't be. As is often the case for road teams across baseball. It will be the place for pure love. The ceremony will begin an hour and a half after the game. So that's it. It goes on to give details, but
great.
Yeah.
Pretty great story. Just happened to come across this afternoon. Yeah. How one game shaped this man's life. And he's not even really a player.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm going to read a few little parts of one other piece, and then I think we'll open it up to questions because we'd love to hear some of your loves or confusions or
hates,
special moments. Thomas Boswell, who has been a regular writer for, I think, the Baltimore Sun, and has written books with titles like Why Time Begins on Opening Day and How Life Imitates Baseball, collections of his short baseball essays. He wrote one entitled 99 Reasons Why Baseball is Better Than Football. And I'm just going to read half a dozen of them. He begins by saying, "Some people say football is the best game in America. Others say baseball. Some people are really dumb. Some people say this is all just a matter of taste. Others know better. Pro football is a great game." He wrote this the week before the Super Bowl, 23 years ago. "Pro football is a great game compared with hockey. After all, you've got to do something when the wind chill is zero and your curveball won't break. But let's not be silly. Compare the games, it's a one-sided laugher. Here are the first 99 reasons why baseball is better than football." More after lunch. Number one, bands. Number two, halftime with bands. Number three, cheerleaders at halftime with bands. Number four, up with people singing the Impossible Dream during a Blue Angels flyover at halftime with bands. Then he goes on to a variety of other things. Nicknames. Number six, baseball has Blue Moon, Catfish, Spaceman, and the Sugar Bear. Football has Lester the Molester, Too Mean, and the Assassin. Baseball, this is number nine. Baseball has a bullpen coach blowing bubble gum with his cap turned around backward while leaning on a fungo bat. Football has a defensive coordinator in a satin jacket with a headset and a clipboard. Number 23, everything George Carlin said in his famous monologue is right on. In football, you blitz, bomb, spear, shiver, march, and score. In baseball, you wait for a walk, take your stretch, toe the rubber, tap your spikes, play ball, and run home. And more from George Carlin. That's a much longer monologue than just that. Number 24, loved Christy Mathewson. No woman of quality has ever preferred football to baseball. You can tell he's trying to get us to respond. And number 25, more good baseball books appear in a single year than have been written about football in the past 50 years. The best football writers have the good sense to write about something else most of the time. And two more. The best football announcer ever was Howard Cosell. The worst baseball announcer ever was Howard Cosell. Well, let's hear a few things. If you have favorite baseball movies, if you have some baseball memories, some baseball holy relic that you have in your home, it'd be fun to talk about it. Yeah.
Well, for someone who came here and didn't know anything on the board, I was kind of thinking, my life isn't really connected to baseball, and then you guys read those past two things, and I realized, like, whew, one, I have two older brothers, and my dad on both, or all three played baseball when I was growing up, and my dad did until he like hurt his shoulder. And so as a 9-year-old, I was very upset that I had to go to like 3 games a week. I actually just wrote this creative writing piece about, it's called Peanuts and Cracker Jacks, about my family, and my parents were divorced, so it was like on the weekends at my dad's, we had to go to like all these baseball games. So it was horrendous for me. But after writing it, I kind of realized that it was like this family bonding thing,
yeah.
Like between taking care of my sister and finding quarters under the bleachers to buy licorice and climbing trees. And my dad actually got married on a baseball field, which just kind of shows how much like my family is into baseball. And I thought it was funny your things about the reasons why. Because I have, it's from a, like a 9-year-old perspective, it's pretty bratty, and it says something like, football games have a band and cheerleaders, football games have hot chocolate, football games have a clock that runs out, not baseball. Like, you go anywhere from 2 hours until Jesus comes back. But at the end, like for me now, as someone who doesn't really go to baseball games because I'm not forced to anymore, I really miss it, actually. And there's something homey and mysterious in it, even though I hated it.
Write that article for Newsweek.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
And just for the record, The Sandlot is the best baseball movie ever created.
Okay, The Sandlot. Okay. Other things, like how did some of you get interested in baseball? Was it the dad taking you to games? You know, how did it all start? And I'd like to hear some more favorite baseball movie titles.
Our daughters had the best coach ever. She was a border collie, and I would pitch the balls, and Beatrix was her name. And from the time the kids were 4 years old, she would shag the. She was the catcher. Didn't mind if they struck out. They never struck out. But they had to get back to home plate. If she got the ball in the outfield, they had to get back to home plate before she did. And she was tremendous, and they both became really, really good ball players. Yeah. You need someone with a lot of patience. There's nothing like a border collie. I recommend. And then you'll get to sit on June afternoons in little valleys in Wisconsin and watch your daughter pitch. There's nothing like
that. Yeah. One Father's Day up here at Holden, my daughter, who was 20 or so at the time, said, Dad, would you play catch with me? And I taught her how to throw a knuckleball that day, and we played catch. One of the best Father's Day moments I've ever had. Yeah.
I was just thinking, is there any wonder why what the miners did with the only piece of flat ground in this valley.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's great, the bleachers are still out there.
Yes,
still
they are.
Just barely see them. Until the Labyrinth came in, we always played baseball, especially the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Where are the bleachers? That'd be cool.
They go up the side of the, as you walk on the path toward Glacier Peak Wilderness, you can still see where the bleachers were.
On the right-hand side.
Right-hand side, and there still are some, you can see where the, there's a little knoll that goes down into the ball field.
And there's a picture down in the pool hall, if it's still there, of a crowd of 100 people watching a baseball game there.
Yeah, the 4th of July parade used to end at the ballpark in the early years, and we had a big picnic, and then we'd play baseball.
Yeah, well, good point. They didn't build an airport or anything there, they built a ballpark. The only flat spot available at the time. Anybody have a,
I got a different kind of story, but you mentioned earlier about a car that was really expensive, didn't you? Something like it was like thousands of dollars. My dad was born in 1945, so he was right around that age. Like, he was like young when he was collecting baseball cards. And he told me a story how he had all of those cards, like rookie, Mickey Mantle rookie card, all mint. And he gave he got older, he was like 20. And he gave them to, he let my uncles have them, who were younger than him. And my uncles traded their neighbors for beat up comic books for them. And my dad was like, why did you do that? Why did you get rid of those? So he went back to, this is in Joliet, Illinois, by Chicago. And he went back and tried to find the cars, but the neighbors had gotten rid of them. But basically, if he would have still had the cards, it would have been like a lot of college tuition.
Yeah. I still look around up at my parents' cabin and amongst their belongings, hoping that I'll find the cards that my parents threw out during spring cleaning when I was away at college.
Oh, there's so many stories like that.
Yeah. And the only reason I still have the Andy Pathko card is that I had a big scrapbook on Andy Pathko at Clippings, and all the cards were pasted into there. So I didn't lose those cards.
How'd you pick Andy Pathko?
We lived in Chicago. He was the franchise player for the Cubs at that time. But I think my dad influenced me, unbeknownst to me, because he was a good Lutheran young man. And because of that, I got to meet Andy Pathko later in the locker room after Milwaukee Braves game, because Dad knew the pastor in Milwaukee who was Andy Pathko's pastor, and it all worked out. So, but that was it, I think. Dad said something about Andy Pathko, and we focused on him, and that's why I was 7 or 8 years old.
When you said that the baseball, hitting a baseball is the hardest athletic thing to do, I played football, basketball, baseball, and track in high school, and I started every single game in baseball, played the whole game, my senior year, every game. I never got a single hit. I didn't play baseball anywhere after that.
Yeah.
The Minnesota Twins have a new stadium, of course, and if you're from those parts, maybe you've had a chance to go to that place. My son Daniel and I went there, I don't know, 6 weeks or so ago. We were the guests of Pastor Don Rudrud, who some of you may have crossed paths
with. Of ours.
And Don also brought with him a client of the place where both Don and I work now, a food shop in South Minneapolis, a guy named Nate, who wouldn't really have had a prayer of getting to that stadium if it were not for Don's gracious offer. And so as we were walking up to this brand new stadium, Don gave Nate his ticket, and within about 10 yards and 1 minute's time, Nate had lost his ticket. He's handicapped in some ways, and Don wasn't sure whether he should have given it to him or not, but nonetheless, it was quite gone. Yeah. So we went to the window, the ticket booth, and said our sad story. And the lady said, well, were you sitting all together? And yes, we were all sitting together. Looked up the other seats, and in maybe 2 minutes' time, Nate had a brand new ticket. Their technology is so good there that they were able to just look it up, and Nate walked in and was just about the happiest. And the Twins won. Walk off. Bad pitch.
Where is that stadium? The new one.
Downtown Minneapolis.
Right downtown, right near where the basketball.
Old Target Center.
Basketball.
West side.
By the Target Center.
Yeah.
It's pretty spectacular. Pretty expensive. I was kind of crappy about the amount of money they spent on it, including how it's affected my taxes. But that day, they're helping Nate feel a little better.
I still am fascinated, though, about the why of that kind of extreme passion that so many of you have. I grew up with a father who loved baseball, and I went to baseball games all my life as a little kid. And mostly I played with my friends there. But I, you know, it rubbed off. I learned quite a bit about it. And then married David, who spends a lot of time thinking about baseball and talking with other people who feel the same way. And I still, I sort of shake my head about it, because it's this intense, from statistics to, you know, I can really enjoy a good baseball game. And the part that I get excited about is how beautiful a field is and the arcs of hits that happen and the sort of ballet aspect of the athleticism of it. But I still say why, because mostly I don't care. I don't even really care about the Twins.
Bless me.
Well,
I'll just throw that out.
Well, I've heard that many times from other people, and I would never say this to you, but what I say to other people when they ask that, I just say, you'll mature. Well, it's past 7:15. It'll be fun to keep right on going. For us, at least. Seeing the movie, which is going to show at 8 o'clock, I think, right here.
Where's the next door? I think it's next door because of Copland's here.
Okay. Quick thing. It's my favorite baseball movie, and not everybody's favorite, but it's well worth seeing, and lots to talk about after that movie. Thank you for coming.